You're listening to TalkTainmentRadio.com.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guest and not necessarily those of TalkTainmentRadio.com, the management, the staff, or K&E World Network, LLC.
Point West with Bobby West, heard exclusively on TalkTainmentRadio.com. Radio, the way it should be heard. Point West, West, West.
All righty, good morning wherever you are, and welcome to Point West, here and heard exclusively on TalkTainmentRadio.com. What we're going to do today, in this first hour, we're going to have and talk about Black Wall Street. What happened in, they say, Tulsa, Oklahoma, but also the suburb of Greenwood. Maybe some things that you don't know, but we're going to talk about that in the first hour. And if we have time at the end of the or conclusion of it, we may do some phone calls. It's going to just depend on how it goes. And then on the second hour, we're going to have a discussion about the Dred Scott decision, what you should know and why we should talk about that. That'll be in the second hour. So those two things are on the menu today. And without further ado, let me say this. This is TalkTainmentRadio.com. We go where you go on the world's greatest radio. And this show is called Point West. And this is radio. This is radio the way it should be heard. All righty. So, without further ado, we're not ready yet. Okay. Well, as soon as we get ready, I'll get the signal, and then we will start this program. Actually, we're going to start it about 10 minutes in, and then you'll be able to glean some information. So, get your pen and paper ready, or if you feel like you have a good memory and you can remember some things, but some very interesting facts about that. I doubt if any of you or any of us heard this in school. I know I didn't, not even in college. We didn't hear anything about that. But it must be brought out so that we know about it. Because if we don't know about it, we are subject to repeat the mistakes that were made in there and dispel old rumors and things that are not true that have gotten into our society right now. Now, you hear me speaking this because we're still trying to cue it up in the right way. So I don't want to hog up the whole program or anything like that. But anyway, this is what we're going to do. And like I said, if we have some time at the end, you know, I will accept your call. So you can call 1-877-932-9766 or you can Gmail me at the numeral 7, Mr. Bobby, B-O-B-B-Y, at gmail.com. Okay, I got the signal, and here we go.
As I sit here, I wonder, with blacks fighting for equal rights and integration in other parts of the United States at that time, was it really a good idea for blacks living in Greenwood to integrate?
But what happened by 1921? Was not so much what happened on the black side, but what happened on the white side of the city. Because we had a lot of veterans coming back from Belleau Wood and Chateau Terry and the Argonne Forest, and they couldn't find jobs. And a lot of these were white, uneducated, lower economic class folks. And when they came back to Tulsa, the Klan milked that resentment that they held for those black prosperous businessmen. And the Klan did the same to them that the Nazis did in Germany in 1933. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. You can make an analogy here that is historically profound. We had a microcosmic experience with the Nazis. The Nazis in Germany in 1933 blamed the Jews, and they persecuted the Jews, and they segregated the Jews, and they created ghettos for the Jews. And that's how they built their power, but they built their power on the disenfranchised and the disenchanted Germans. Well, the Nazis took over an entire country. The Ku Klux Klan, in this case, largely took over an entire city. And for that matter, to some degree, the entire state and maybe the region of the country in which they were strong. But they played on the hate and the fear and the envy and the jealousy of many of these whites who had felt that the country owed them something because they had fought in World War I. And here you have blacks who possibly didn't fight in World War I and were very prosperous. And you had the seeds for that kind of conflict economically. Now socially, you had a different situation. Oklahoma is a very unique state in the sense that it's the only state in the Union that was settled the way it was. This was Indian territory. It wasn't even a southern state in the Civil War. For that matter, it wasn't even a northern state. It was a state that was fought over by both sides. In fact, there were 69 battles fought in Oklahoma, largely between northern and southern Indians. But when the state was settled, it was settled by land runs. Benjamin Harrison opened up chunks of the state, and people just ran over this land and plotted out their portions. Now, why is that significant in terms of the riot? It's significant because an awful lot of those folks that made those land runs were Southerners whose farms and lands and plantations had been burned by Sherman and the Union Army when they went through the South. They had no homes left, so they came west. And when they made those land runs, they brought in Southern culture with them. As a result, what you have here in Oklahoma is a microcosm of the United States. The northern half of the state is more metropolitan, in fact, politically, more Republican. The northern half of the state was settled by farmers from Kansas, which was largely Union territory. The southern half of the state was largely settled by folks from the South, Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas. And the state pretty much splits that way in terms of politics and economics and social development. But when you add that extra economic jealousy and envy to it, the Ku Klux Klan had a breeding ground. And that's the reason they were able to hold parades that lasted 4 to 5 hours at a shot. There were an awful lot of people that were more than willing to hate blacks because they represented something they wished they had. Little Africa was possibly the most prosperous area that blacks have ever collectively developed any place in the world.
Oklahoma was regarded as one of the cleanest states in the nation and cherished its reputation as being called God's country or the Bible Belt of America. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, as I first stated, my husband predicted this that Sunday night at church. Them days we had BTUs. They about cut them out now, and we don't have no BTU. But he made a public statement and told them that this was going to happen. But we didn't know. We hadn't seen no sign. But after church and after we went home, several men, young men and stuff, you know, they get all shook up and everything. We had a good dear policeman at that time, we called him Bonnie Cleaver, Uncle Bonnie. He was down there trying to corral them because the trouble was arising, and we didn't even know that, with this black man and this white woman. And they down there showing out down to police station and all, and he was riding this big old horse, and he was telling them, you know, it wasn't going to be none of that. But they had guns and everything, and some of them come clear out as far as Latimer Street. That's where we lived. And running by that, men, get your guns. Get your guns. Get your guns.
A very nice feeling to see, to live in a role model community. In other words, you could see people doing on every level that looked like you, so you could set your sights anywhere that you wanted, and you felt secure. I don't really remember seeing any other cultural group except Native Americans and Mexicans.
Right.
I don't ever remember seeing them.
You didn't have much interaction with whites then?
No, absolutely not.
All right, but your dad did.
Yeah, I saw him at the store when we went to the store. Yeah.
All right, and so they would come to the store to sell product.
Yeah. Right, that's true. And
so that was the extent of pretty much what you had to do with the white community.
No,
did the folks ever talk about the problems that existed?
Well, my mother did talk about religion sometime, because my mother had been brought up in the Episcopalian Church.
Mm-hmm.
And
evening,
when she
everybody.
Came to Muskogee to teach, she was told that she could come to church, but she couldn't commune. And that was outrageous to her, because she had been born in Brownsville, Texas, and they allowed her to commune there.
Sure.
So she immediately joined the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which was all black.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that, because Mother had told us about that incident. So we knew that there was friction somewhere, but we never experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
There were people working in the neighborhood. There was a brickyard right across the street from us. There were many whites that worked in the brickyard across from our home.
Right.
But there were milkmen who drove drays, you know, with a horse, mm-hmm. and so forth, mm-hmm. and so on. There were firemen who were white.
Yep.
If there was a fire, they came and put it out. Of course, they didn't have what they have now to put fires out with. So we saw them, and there was a little train that came.
Exact same location where it was bombed and completely destroyed exactly 70 years ago.
In 1921, a man's word was his bond. You measured the masculinity of a man by how much he kept his word. The congregation of the Mount Zion Baptist Church sticks in my mind because the year before the riot, the black congregation took out a 20-year mortgage and built this brand new church. And the Klan burned it to the ground. But instead of running out on their mortgage, instead of telling the bank, you're just going to have to take your losses, that congregation took out another 20-year mortgage and paid off both mortgages simultaneously. That's character. There were other heroes too. Many of the whites in the southern part of the city had black employees, and those employees had become almost extensions of their family. In fact, a lot of Tulsans were raised by black domestic employees, and when the riot erupted, many of those families hid those blacks in their basement at great jeopardy to themselves, because if the Klan had ever found out that a white had hidden a black in their basement, the white family would have been persecuted, if not horsewhipped. Probably the two most singular heroes out of the riot was the Tulsa County Sheriff and the Tulsa County Black Deputy Sheriff. Willard McCullough was a Tulsa County Sheriff at that time, and he was the only sheriff in the whole state that had black deputies. His chief black deputy was Barney Cleaver. And you got to keep in mind, when that riot erupted around the Tulsa County Courthouse, there weren't more than maybe a dozen deputies in that building. And Willard McCullough stood on the south steps of the Tulsa County Courthouse and told a mob of several thousand Ku Klux Klansmen who were heavily armed that he was not going to release Dick Rowland. Barney Cleaver stood on the north steps of the county courthouse and told the black crowd that they weren't going to release Dick Rowland. Well, you put yourself in the position of a white county sheriff in a southern state in 1921, facing several thousand Ku Klux Klansmen, and you don't have more than maybe a dozen deputies to back you up. And Barney Cleaver's on the north side of the courthouse telling a black crowd the same thing. I don't know much about Barney Cleaver or Willard McCullough before or since then, but I can tell you this. On May 31st, 1921, they became, maybe earned the right to become world-class cops.
Sort of a happenstance. What happened was that my father owned a Mosler safe, and everything in the store was destroyed, but he was down there in the rubble one day, and he kicked the safe, and it seemed to be all right. So he worked the combination and opened it, and everything was intact. And because it was the only safe in the neighborhood that was that safe, a lot of people who lived by various means that weren't may not have even been legal used to bring their money to Pop to keep.
Uh-huh.
So he, and they always put their name on a paper bag.
Right,
and
right,
so he went around and gave everybody their money back. And they said, you don't mean that our money's still good. And there were quite a few people who had left their money with Dad in the safe. And then he had a little money in there of his own. And so that was okay. He had some bonds in there, and those were okay. And that's what he used to make a tour of the United States with Mr. Gregg, the Secretary of the Y. They went to black churches in Washington, St. Louis, places like that, to tell people what had happened, because the Scripps Howard newspapers had decided to keep it quiet, to make
a secret.
So
they did get out there to tell the story.
Well, they did, only to black churches, however.
Yep.
And
so it takes it till now to get this to people in general, to let them know
and at the
really
time,
what happened.
Scripps Howard and the Hearst newspapers were so powerful that they had people following Mr. Gregg and Dad when they went on the speaking tour. And I guess they probably would have done something to them, but they were clever enough to just read quotations when they got to the place where they were describing all these dastardly things that had gone on. They would quote what somebody had written in a magazine or a newspaper instead of telling it as a first-person story. And so the FBI, or whatever preceded the FBI in those days, wasn't able to say they're inciting to riot because they were quoting from a paper.
Robin told me, so we got to go. And I said, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to go out there. He said, yeah, you got to go. See, remember, he had told the people he couldn't hardly get me out of the house. So I gave him a little argument about it, but I had to go. And I just held my barefoot sandals and had a head rag on my head. And he said, let's go. We can't stay here. He said, we got to keep moving. So he got out there and he went to preaching to the people. See, we was very thickly settled in on both sides of the streets. And all the houses was burnt down on my side, on this side and that side, but two houses, my house and another. All the rest of them was burnt down. See, all those little people, every chance they got, they would stick fire to the house. And all that fire was burning and folks was hollering, some of them and running. And my husband told him, said, don't run, said, walk and stay out in the opening where they'll see you. And so won't nobody get shot.
No, what had happened to our father and our brother, you see, they still weren't turned.
When you went home,
No, there
just the ladies,
the
children.
And things were very much upset and disturbed. And the thing that bothered me the most was that I had seen them set fire to my doll clothes. And I thought that was the last straw. The doll clothes were hanging on the line because the lady that used to help us had washed all the clothes. My grandmother was a fine seamstress, and she had made the doll all kinds of good things. And then to see them take a torch and set them on fire on the line.
So sad.
Children. It was. I mean, children, cherish their possessions. And a child who's never seen any hatred.
The
Klan was extraordinarily powerful in Tulsa in 1921, but then again, it was extraordinarily powerful throughout Oklahoma. As a matter of fact, during the 20s, Oklahoma impeached and convicted two governors, allegedly, of course, for other charges, but it was an open secret that one of the principal reasons they got impeached and convicted was that they were anti-Klan. Majority of the Oklahoma legislature were either Klansmen or supported by the Klan. But then Oklahoma was not unusual. States all across the country had that kind of influence on them. But in Tulsa County itself, there was a rather unique situation that developed. In the late teens, the Glenpool oil field was roaring. And that's just west of Tulsa County. An awful lot of money poured into this city. And the whites, who were the big oil men, lived on the east side of the Arkansas River. The roughnecks who worked the rigs lived on the west side. Well, there wasn't enough housing on the west side, so a lot of the roughnecks would come over to the east side and live in rooming houses on 12-hour shifts. A lot of people said that was due to the housing shortage. A great degree it had to do with the working cycle of a roughneck on a rig, as roughnecks work 12-hour shifts on rigs. The point here is that a lot of the money that poured into Tulsa, that helped build Tulsa into the beautiful city it became, was also poured into the Ku Klux Klan. And the Klan became extraordinarily well-financed. With that sound financing that they received from those oil men who were sympathetic to the Klan and who were, in fact, effectively manipulating the lower white economic classes to their own benefit, the Klan in Tulsa had a lot of money to do a lot of things that other Klan claverns didn't have that kind of support to do. For example, they had a building, a headquarters, here in Tulsa. It was called Beano Hall. Now, what did Beano stand for? It stood for Beano Jew, Beano Nigger, Beano Catholic. I think it's ironic that Beano Hall eventually evolved into a pig barn. There were not only lynchings, but there were other forms of persecution. The Ku Klux Klan was real big on providing character guidance, attitude adjustment, and behavior modification on anybody they disagreed with. Not only including blacks, but whites who they regarded as violating their standards. It wasn't uncommon for a white person, for example, who might have been going out on his wife, to be hauled out of his house one night and tied to a tree and flogged by men dressed in sheets. Many blacks, however, were lynched. They were lynched by such organizations as not only the Ku Klux Klan, but the Knights of the White Camellia. There were all kinds of super secret little organizations that were self-appointed vigilantes. As a matter of fact, the Justice Department itself created the American Protective League during World War I and made it function under the FBI, which at that time was not the FBI we know today. It was a politicized FBI. But the American Protective League was largely an organization of volunteer civilian white men designed to ferret out any individuals of Germanic descent in Tulsa County and watch them to see if they conducted any espionage or pro-Kaiser activities during World War I. The American Protective League was formally disbanded after World War I, but that will give you an idea of the kind of mentality that existed then. But to address your question, yes, there were lynchings. And to give you an example, several weeks before the Tulsa riot, in Wagner, which is a small town east of Tulsa. A black man had been arrested on a minor charge and incarcerated in the Wagon County Jail. And that night, the sheriff, or the guard or deputy, whoever was responsible for the jail, conveniently went out to get a sandwich, just as a crowd of people dressed in white robes entered the jail, took the man out, put a noose around his neck, wrapped the other end of the rope around the bumper of a Model T Ford and dragged him down the middle of Wagner Main Street. And that sort of thing didn't just happen in Oklahoma. That sort of thing happened across the country. And there were many lynchings before the riot. And I'm sorry to say there were many lynchings after the riot. But there weren't any lynchings in Tulsa County after the riot that I'm aware of.
That my mother had actually shed tears. I had never seen her cry. And I had never heard her speak in that loud a tone.
Yeah.
And a little thing like burning down a town was quite small to me in comparison with my shock to see this absolutely strong, immovable, immutable, mm-hmm. invincible
right.
person with tears with rolling down her cheeks. So that was really the riot to me.
And so then coming back home, it was the determination to make things, to get things back to where they were?
Well, we naturally, we hoped we could. We didn't know how we would because, you know, with the store completely destroyed. At that time, Papa didn't know that the insurance wasn't going to pay. I mean, everybody assumed their fire insurance.
An act of God.
But everybody assumed that that their fire insurance would cover at least, you know, the basics. But I had many nightmares after that. I couldn't sleep at night, and they were really worried about me because it was such a shock to me. I think Irene and Leslie knew about prejudice, but I didn't.
Right, right.
The interesting thing that happened during the riot was that the riot lasted almost all night of May 31st, 1921, and into the early morning hours of June 1st, 1921, before law enforcement authorities were able to get anything under control. The city police didn't want anything to do with trying to control the Ku Klux Klan. As a matter of fact, the chief of police, a man by the name of Gustafson.
Just download the TalkTainmentRadio.com app to your cell or to your tablet. Podcasts are available. That's radio the way it should be heard. Stay right there. We're going to conclude the Black Wall Street, a Holocaust in America, after these words.
For the best home fragrance and beauty products, shop Ash Kicking online.
That's Ash Kicking.
Made with 100% natural quality ingredients and handcrafted with your family in mind, Ash Kicking products are better than those other guys. Ash Kicking candles, incense, body butter, face moisturizer, and hair moisturizer are priced just right, and you can get yours at 10% off with coupon code TALK17. Support this 100% Black-owned business and get your home and body smelling and feeling all right.
That's
Shop Ash Kicking online at www.ashkickin.com.
Now we back from paying the bills, baby. Maybe we'll fire the landlord. This next song is dedicated to all the cool cats and...
Attention, Central Ohio.
Stand by for an important message.
Someone once said, these times like all times are good times if we just know what to do. Linco Realty says this is the best time to buy or sell a home because interest rates are the lowest in history. Linco Realty has been providing real estate services for over 40 years in Central Ohio. Let us help you fire your landlord. If you have questions on pre-approvals, credit scores, down payments, financing, down payment assistance programs, schools, or other real estate questions, go to LincoRealty.com or call us at 614-375-2289. Again, 614-375-2BUY. Fire your landlord. Call us at 614-375-2289. Check out LincoRealty.com, then start packing.
Supporting minority education. I'm Sean Booker, damn it. I'm here to tell you that as the mother of a high school senior, I know due to financial circumstances, many of America's deserving minority students do not have access to a college education. Since 1944, the United Negro College Fund has sought to provide one. Since 1972, the beginning of this campaign, UNCF has helped more than 300,000 talented students earn a college degree. I'm Sean Booker, damn it. Give a helping hand.
The Glory Soul Food Cafe, a taste of Southern classic, located at 3350 Allegheny Avenue in Columbus, Ohio. For carryout, call 614-237-5844 or go to DoorDash.com. Soul food specials on Wednesdays. Get the menu at LaGloriesCafe.com for the best eating in town.
That's LaGlory Soul Food Cafe, 3350 Allegheny Avenue, Columbus, Ohio. For carryout, dial 614-237-5844 or go to DoorDash.com.
Have you ever wished you could spend more time with your kids, or maybe quality time with your spouse, when you can actually have an uninterrupted conversation? Do you owe your dad a little catch-up time? Well, it's time to reconnect, and no activity can bond a family together quite like boating and fishing. I mean, think of all the great experiences you had as a kid when you went boating or fishing. Well, guess what? It's still great. Boating and fishing are the perfect opportunities for your family to get away, to talk, to laugh, to create new memories. So take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you. If you haven't been on the water in a while and you're not sure where to start, or if you just like to have some helpful tips for your next trip, please visit TakeMeFishing.org. This has been a public service of Talktainment Radio. Radio, the way it should be heard.
Sex Code War by Kahari Inaharo, the author of the Essence Magazine bestseller Race Code War, is releasing his second book, Sex Code War. Be on the lookout for Sex Code War.
Supporting minority education. I'm Sean Booker, damn it. I'm here to tell you that as the mother of a high school senior, I know due to financial circumstances, many of America's deserving minority students do not have access to a college education. Since 1944, the United Negro College Fund has sought to provide one. Since 1972, the beginning of this campaign, UNCF has helped more than 300,000 talented students earn a college degree. I'm Sean Booker, damn it. Give a helping hand.
Here's an idea. You've heard of the notion of pay it forward. It comes from the 2000 movie Pay It Forward. Basically, the premise is helping someone with no expectations of payback, providing assistance to someone, passing information on, simply doing a good deed for a total stranger, and instead of allowing them to pay it back, ask them to pay it forward. Doing favors for other people and asking them to do the same. The principle is the same as multi-level marketing, except that instead of soap or vitamins, it's generosity between strangers that is being passed on. Pay It Forward is mentoring. It's volunteering in your community. It's shoveling a neighbor's snow or cutting an elderly person's grass for them or taking a senior to the store. Don't wait for someone else to do something good. Do it yourself. It starts with you. Talktainment Radio strongly embraces the notion of pay it forward. In fact, we just did.
My name is Al Edmondson. I'm a business owner and community organizer. I want to encourage you to visit the King Lincoln District, our community. It's a great place to live, work, and worship. Catch a show at the Lincoln Theater. Enjoy smooth jazz at the King Arts Complex. Enjoy great food and visit our historical churches and newly remodeled homes. Live, work, and worship the King Lincoln District.
Goodwill is a global social services enterprise and the leading nonprofit provider of job training programs and career services in the United States and Canada. To pay for its program, Goodwill sells donated clothes and other household items in more than 2,700 stores and online at shopgoodwill.com. Goodwill uses the revenue earned from these sales to fund job training, employment placement services, and other community programs. The goal of the campaign is to increase goods donations to Goodwill, inspire an emotional connection to the Goodwill brand, and to elevate preference for Goodwill.
At TalkTainmentRadio.com,
We don't just talk. We don't just entertain. We've combined talk radio with the latest in online entertainment, with the ability to listen live at no cost 24/7. We are the premier online radio station. Outperforming the digital quality of our competitors, our shows are produced in a state-of-the-art studio by the best radio professionals in the business. Hosting live shows on location at some of the area's greatest and most popular events, we give you exactly what you want to hear with talk radio that matters to you. Join us online at talktainmentradio.com, where you can listen live or play podcasts from the best shows in online talk radio. We give you a reason to come. We give you a reason to stay. Talktainmentradio.com. Radio, the way it should be heard.
You've got the power.
You are the power.
Right here on Talktainment Radio.
Bradley, now we return for the conclusion of Black Wall Street, a Black Holocaust in America. I'm giving you some ideas of what happened for the in Tulsa, actually Greenwood, a suburb of Tulsa. They say between 300 and 3,000 people, men, women, and children, were lost. And then as soon as we get the signal, we'll go ahead on. Okay. All right, here we go with the conclusion.
Okay. Gave them to two of his crony police officers on the Tulsa police force, which I might point out, with some justification, was a politicized police force at that time, not the police force that Tulsa has today, which is a first-class department. But the point was, in those days, he gave those confiscated vehicles to those two police officers who went out and sold them to whites, and then they shared the profit. Chief Gustafson was later indicted for this and removed from public office in June of 1921. But there were many other indictments too. And many of these indictments were the byproduct of National Guard boards of inquiry. Now what happened in the riot, and this is fascinating, was that here you have a major war going on in the downtown portion of Tulsa that erupted and moved north into the north part of the city, eventually wiping out the north part of the city, devastating it totally. And yet the mayor, none of the city commissioners, called the governor. Now at that time, we only had one 40-man ambulance company in the Oklahoma National Guard stationed in Tulsa. The governor at that time didn't know there was a riot in Tulsa until the next morning, because no city or county official notified him, with the exception of the county sheriff. The county sheriff sent one of his black deputies through the north part of the city towards Sand Springs. He got to Sand Springs to a telegraph. And keeping in mind the telephone lines were down, the telegraph lines were down, the railroad tracks were torn up, there were Ku Klux Klansmen standing on roadblocks trying to catch blacks who were trying to escape the city, and there were refugees as far away as Kansas City and Wichita and Muskogee, Oklahoma. That deputy got to that telegraph and telegraphed the governor on behalf of the county sheriff that there was a riot in Tulsa and law and order had broken down. J.B.A. Robertson, who was governor at the time, sent the adjutant general, who is the top military officer in the National Guard in Oklahoma, to Tulsa. The adjutant general arrived and immediately sized up the situation as being exactly what the governor had been told by that deputy. And the adjutant general mobilized the Oklahoma National Guard, and they sent in guard units from as far away as Enid and Lawton, Oklahoma City and Muskogee and places like that. And a lot of people attribute the troops that arrived were federal troops. They weren't federal troops. Federal troops were never deployed here. This was the Oklahoma National Guard that came in. Many of the survivors who I interviewed when they were still alive told me, frankly, the black survivors, they told me, frankly, they wouldn't have been alive that day if it hadn't been for Oklahoma National Guardsmen. Because the guardsmen came in and the very first thing they did was declare martial law and threatened to shoot anybody who was found armed. They set up internment compounds to protect black refugees, because black refugees were scattered all over the city. Their homes were burned. They had no place to go. And so they set up internment compounds around the city in various parks and places like this.
So, but I didn't tell you, one of my husband's best friends was killed that day while we was in that rush. See, he told them not to run and don't get in close places because they'd be just shooting that bunch. This fellow was named Willie Lockett. He and my husband were great friends. And I said to him, "So where are you going, Willie?" He said, "I don't know, man, so I'm just going." And he was on a horse, and they said this was one of their favorite horses of the Lockett family. So T.I. told him to be careful and stay out in the open. But he was killed that day.
Every single insurance company that had a policy covering any kind of damage to homes or commercial businesses or industry cut and ran on their insurance policy because a riot wasn't included. The federal government and state governments didn't have programs in place to compensate citizens for being the victims of a breakdown of law and order. So effectively, the citizens who lived in Little Africa took the entire loss. The problem was that when we're talking entire loss, we're talking everything. There was no FDIC then. They might have had their money in a bank, and if the bank was burned and the money stolen, there was no way to recoup it. Jewelry stores in Little Africa were stripped clean. Furniture was taken out of homes. Everything was gone, and the homes were burned to the ground. So when we're talking about refugees, we're talking about refugees that have nothing left except what they carried on their back.
Was a good friend of mine. She and her husband gave birth to a little baby that night, and you know, I guess they didn't have nothing to put it in because there wasn't no conveniences. They put it in a shoebox, newborn baby, but some people, you know, some people that day, you couldn't stop them from running. We had to walk because that was our safest way. But these people was running, and seemed as though that they set this box down where this baby was and to rest because people got awfully tired and they couldn't find it. It was stillborn, already dead. But they didn't want to throw it away. They wanted to take it home and then have the film. But they didn't get to. And there were so many things that taking place that day. Now we lost our best doctor the next morning. But they told me that he stood somewhere down one of those buildings down by the where that little three corner place is on Greenwood. You know, it's a rooming house on that side and you know, something like that on this side and in the brickyard. Well, they said he stood along there and he just mowed quite a few of them down.
And by 1925, you couldn't tell. Well, there was still some rubble on Archer Street, but for the most part, you couldn't really tell that it had been a completely devastated community.
And they did
people
it by,
built houses. They had built houses, and they built stores, and they built hotels, and put back an elementary school. The elementary school had been completely bombed out, but they had
so they were back with their schools and back with their pride, and
yes.
And nothing was going to stop them.
That's the way they felt. Now, they had a lot of trouble building because somebody thought of the idea of making an ordinance that no one could build a one-story house. If you built, you had to build two stories on a certain amount. You see, that was a zoning that was passed surreptitiously
right.
to keep them from building back on that spot because the town really wanted to expand out there. But there was an attorney, B.C. Franklin, and a couple of other lawyers, black lawyers, mm-hmm. who went to court and won that case that the people owned their land. They could build back on their land, mm-hmm. whatever they chose, and that they didn't have to live by these specifications that the zoning people had put in that were really artificial. You know,
this is over 70 years, right?
Yes.
Since the fire.
Yes. Been a long
what do you,
time.
What do you think now about a fire, about being in Tulsa as a little girl then?
Well, I guess looking back, I'm very glad I had that kind of start where I never had to wonder whether or not you could do something or accomplish something.
Yeah.
There were so many people who had and did, and knowing people, when you're a child and you know people who look like you, who own airplanes.
Yeah.
It does something for you.
Yeah.
So that it was, in many ways, a very privileged. We weren't rich, but it was a very privileged kind of experience. It never occurred to me to think that Mexicans or Native Americans were inferior or different mm-hmm. or that we shouldn't, because I had always been brought up, you know, where
yeah,
they were around, and
sure.
that's sort of, so it wasn't a matter of talking about it. I think it has been a very good investment because there's been so much hate and dissension now that if I had understood more, mm-hmm. I would be a much different person, a much yeah. meaner person.
All right.
There were witnesses that an airplane crossed the black community by air and something was thrown out of it. There were explosions. The problem is that you don't have a cause and effect direct relationship, because Tulsa was piped by natural gas in those days, as it is today. And many of the homes were already burning. So, from a more precise perspective, there isn't hard proof that a plane came over the black community and dropped bombs on the black community. However, there have been a couple of things we've been able to establish. There was a plane over the black community. There were things thrown out of it. There are some interesting conclusions you can reach from some available evidence. First, it wasn't a government plane. There were only about a half dozen planes in the state at that time that belonged to the government. There was no Air Force then. The Air National Guard didn't exist. And there were about a half a dozen biplanes at Fort Sill. None of them took off the ground during this period. But this was the period of barnstormers. It wasn't uncommon for a pilot who learned how to fly in World War I to have a biplane and to fly around the country and do tricks at state fairs and maybe take somebody up for a couple of dollars. That, in all likelihood, was what happened then, that a barnstormer who had his own airplane actually flew over the black community. Now, if he threw out anything, and if it was a bomb, perfectly understandable how it could have worked, because it doesn't take very much to make a bomb, particularly if you're a veteran of a recent war that had just ended.
Greenwood was soon labeled the Black Wall Street of America. It consisted of highly educated black doctors, lawyers, PhDs, merchants, oilmen, and entrepreneurs.
The interesting thing about this particular situation is that in North Tulsa in 1921, prior to the riot, there existed an area called Little Africa. And that was a mark of respect. The black business community was extraordinarily prosperous. As a matter of fact, possibly the best minds in black America had migrated to North Tulsa in the late teens and early 20s. They built a commercial and business establishment so prosperous that it rivaled any place in the world. In fact, the main street of Little Africa, Greenwood, was euphemistically referred to as the Black Wall Street. There were millionaires that lived there, and some of the architecture of some of the old homes in North Tulsa today represent that particular period.
What do we tell people today about, in reacting to that, what do we learn from it?
Well, I think two things. One is that the newspapers were able to keep it secret. In fact, to perpetrate the lie that everybody got restitution. Nobody got any restitution of anything. But they could fabricate a lie and it would be accepted as truth. And nobody worried about it.
Still true.
And yet the people survived, but not because, you know, they got any kind of justice. And I think one thing that we might have learned by it was that if people really have a strong will and a strong feeling for each other, that it's amazing what can be accomplished. And I'm particularly grateful for the education I got in Tulsa. When we went back to Booker Washington High, it was a fantastic school. The teachers were so well trained, and they couldn't get jobs anywhere else, of course, and so they taught there.
Yep.
And when I went to Columbus, when I went to Columbus, the teachers did not believe that I had been taught all I had been taught, you know, because they thought South, you know. And I remember even in math, the teacher said, can you do quadratic equations? This is ninth grade. I said, well, which method would you like? And she said, what? How many methods do you know? And I said, well, four. She said, in ninth grade, you can do four ways of quadratic equations.
We were talking about and have been talking about Black Wall Street, the fact that it existed. Let's talk just for a minute about the nature of the book. What is the book about?
The book is about the most prolific and wealthiest black community in America. And we tell that story through the eyes of an African-American oil man and a Jewish merchant. We thought it was very important that each one of these characters represent 10 people that you read in this book. We wrote the book very visual. We wrote the book the way kids think. We put undertones in the book to make them turn the pages, and that's what's exciting about the book. The book tells you the story as though you're right there.
And it does, too. And by the way, more than the book, you have a videotape?
We have a videotape out called Black Wall Street, the Holocaust. It's 55 minutes long. It tells you the story of that day of that riot, June 1st, 1921.
Tell our viewers briefly about the children's book.
The children's book is Black Wall Street, A City Made of Gold. That was written by my wife, Annette Wilson, which my wife is Latricia Wallace. And it gives positive images. And we're after positive images in this story. An old man about 80 years old told me that if you write this story, Ron, please do not write about the hate, because the person you may be writing about may be your cousin.
All over the country, our inner city communities are suffering. We're asking 1 million African-Americans to stand up and take back your community. To book a Black Wall Street town hall meeting, give us a call at 1-800-527-7299. Call today.
I wish we had more time, and we don't. Sorry we have to close. On behalf of Ron and Latricia Wallace and the Black Wall Street team, I want to thank you for being here with us. It was wonderful. Thank you for the important role that you played in American history.
At the conclusion of some historical information concerning Black Wall Street, as it's called, to a northern part of Tulsa, Oklahoma, the things that happened in there, the things that were not put in the history books that we didn't learn about, that we didn't know about, as if it never existed. You heard those two sisters say even the newspapers back then in Tulsa conspired to not print the story at all. So nobody really knew what was going on. That's why we have to research that. We have to have our own schools to get, as Joanne would say, the stuff under the stuff. because it's basically a constructed lie. And if you think about it, we've been lied to all of our lives, even about our history. There's a good book out that I would recommend that you get. It's called The Destruction of the Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams. It's an excellent book and can go back, it goes back and trace the history of our people and what we had to come through and all that. Some of it is hard because all of our people were not righteous people, but it just goes to show you what happened and how, where we ascend, where we came from, what we did. And even the strong women who were, I don't want to say kings, but they were princesses and so forth. The history of our people, it goes on and on and on. Chancellor Williams is the author of The Destruction of the Black Civilization. Now, some people might interpret this as hate, but it's not. It's not hate. You just want to be informed of what is truth, throw out what is lie and replace it with truth. We don't hate anybody. We just don't. We don't like a lot of stuff that goes in, but we don't want hate to exist. We want our people to wake up, to be alive, to understand and know things. A lot of times, and I don't hate to say this, but the Bible is right when it says in Hosea 4:6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. It's very difficult to get people to read and to understand, to have an intelligent conversation about what's going on. And it's just rough. You know, you try to have that. We have to be taught these things as they have taught us to kill ourselves and so forth. You know, violence all over. Somebody mentioned there's no such thing as black on black crime. Okay, well, how about blacks killing blacks, period? Yeah, you have whites that kill whites too, but brothers and sisters, we should not be doing this kind of activity. And here in the Black Wall Street, they were a very prosperous community, and the white leaders of Tulsa did not like that, so they conspired to destroy it and burn it down. But you didn't hear about it in the history books. They, in fact, it was so prosperous, It employed even white people there. They had churches, schools, not just barbershops, but churches, schools. They had black farmers and so forth. They produced stuff. And they were in direct competition with the already established white community. And they didn't like that because they were very, very prosperous. I think one of the people referred to a lot of people in there as millionaires. And of course, they had oil. Oklahoma is famous for oil. But we didn't know about this. I went to college and didn't even know about this kind of stuff because I was geared or led toward what they wanted me to believe or say or regurgitate until I started to really study and find out that this was not true. It was lies. A lot of people think that Barack Obama is the first black president. And to show you that I'm not lying, if you have a $2 bill, just turn it over and look at the back of it. And the first black president of this so-called United States was a man by the name of John Hanson. But you didn't hear that in you know, you didn't see that in the books. They kept that. Why did they keep that away? Yeah. Under the Continental Conquerors, John Hanson was right there. Well, I'm getting signals. I could go on and on about that, but I have to stop it here. But thanks for listening. You've been listening to Point West, heard exclusively on TalkTainmentRadio.com, and we'll see you in about 2 weeks there. Thanks for listening. TalkTainmentRadio.com, radio the way it should be heard.